Chapter 6. In the morning, he found Sunday in her studio. She had already been busy and industrious. She always had been a morning person. There was fresh bread and milk, the smell of powerful coffee permeating the apartment. "It's very nice," he said, admiring the piece she was working on. It was some kind of half-scale, Maasai-looking figure study, a skeletal stick-thin figure with a spear. Sunday was using a power tool to chisel away at the blade edge of a cheekbone, biting her tongue in fierce concentration. "It's shit, actually. Commissioned work. I'm doing two of them to flank the doorway of an ethnic restaurant in the third cavern." She wore a long skirt, a black t-shirt, and a red headscarf. Power tools dappled with dried white specks dangled from a belt hanging low around her hips. "What pays the rent around here? Not digging into the past of a dead ancestor." "It's still art."
"That's one point of view."
"You don't think so?"
"They wanted something African. I said, you're going to have to narrow it down a bit. Are we talking West Coast, East Coast, are we even sub-Saharan?" "But no. They said, we want to keep it less specific than that."
"Like you say, it pays the rent."
"Guess I shouldn't complain. Picasso drew on napkins to pay his bar tabs. And if this goes in on time, there may be more work when they open another concession across town."
She hooked the power tool back into its loop and unbuckled the belt, draping it onto one of her paint and plaster spattered work surfaces.
"You're up anyway. You want breakfast? I thought we'd hit the zoo today."
"I just grabbed some bread," Jeffrey said. "Where's Jitendra?"
"Asleep. Does all his best thinking unconscious."
She pottered over to a bowl and dipped her hands in water before drying them on her skirt.
"Hope that wasn't too heavy, all that business last night."
"Anything to do with family is bound to err on the heavy side." Jeffrey looked down, realizing he'd trodden in something wet and sticky. "Look, I meant to say, it was absolutely wrong of me not to tell you straight away what I was doing up here, but I felt I was in a bind. If you can forgive me,
I already have. This one time."
She finished drying her fingers, leaving dark ovals on the skirt.
"But listen, you and me, we have to be open with each other. Always used to be, didn't we? You and me against the household, from the moment we worked out how to make nuisances of ourselves. How dear Memphis didn't strangle us, I won't ever know."
"Different back then, though. Being rebellious didn't cost us anything, except maybe being banished to our bedrooms before supper. Now we've got people and things that depend on us.
Doesn't mean we can't be honest with each other, though, does it?"
"The cousins didn't want you to know. They'll spit teeth if they find out I told you."
Sunday moved the sculpture by its base and positioned it under a cluster of blue-tinged lights. "Then we better make damn sure they don't."
Children flew kites and balloons in the park. Others were preoccupied with enormous dragon-like flying contraptions not much smaller than the Cessna, the chief function of which appeared to be battling with other dragon-like flying contraptions. They had glittering foil plumage, bannered tails, and marvelously anatomically precise wings that beat the air with the awesome slowness of a whale's heart. Elsewhere, there were amorous couples, outbreaks of public theatre or oratory, ice cream stands, puppet shows, and a great many fabulously costumed stilt walkers. Jeffrey stared in wonder at an astonishingly beautiful stilt-walking girl, covered with leaves and green face paint, like a tree spirit made carnal.
"Do you think," Sunday asked, "that the cousins had any idea what you might find in the bank?"
"If they did, they hid it well."
"Big risk, though, sending you up to look into the vault."
"Less of a risk than bringing an outsider in."
He tongued the ice cream Sunday had bought him from one of the stands. "Ideally, Hector and Lucas would have come up here in person, but then people would have started wondering why they needed to visit the moon. Before you know it, the whole system would be poking its nose into our Kenya business."
"You think Memphis knows about the vault?"
"If he does, he's said nothing to me." Jeffrey dripped some of the ice cream onto his sleeve. He shifted the fabric to his mouth and licked off the spillage.
"Still, he knows something's going on.
I'm not sure what the rest of the family make of my absence, but Memphis knows I've gone to the moon. Memphis had more contact with Eunice near the end than any of us.
She might have told him things then, I suppose, Jeffrey said, or at any point during the exile. She was up there for more than 60 years.
Maybe the simplest thing would be to ask him directly in that case. See if he knows anything about the glove and the gemstones and a possible connection to Pythagoras.
If you'd like me to.
They navigated the edge of a small civic pond where children splashed in the shallows and little pastel-sailed boats bobbed and battled further out. On the far bank, Jeffrey caught the flash of something small and mammalian emerging from the water before vanishing immediately into tufts of grass. An otter, or maybe a rat, its fur silvery with water.
You're not at all curious about any of this, are you? Sunday said, not bothering to hide her disapproval. When you head home to Africa, it's straight back to your old life.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Just do that one thing for me. Find out what Memphis knows.
Look, before you dig any deeper into this, are you absolutely sure this is something you really want to mess with? You won't be able to do a 5-minute scrub on your own working memory.
I know a good neuropractor.
Not my point.
She wasn't a monster, Jeffrey. A less than perfect human being, maybe. And there's another thing. She put that glove there, not someone else. Isn't it too much of a coincidence that the details of this bank vault suddenly come to light in the weeks after her death? Eunice's fingerprints are all over this.
I hope you're right about that.
After leaving the park, they walked through into the next cavern and eventually stopped at the restaurant where Sunday's commissioned sculptures would be installed. The place was closed for business, dusty from the renovation work. Sunday talked to the interior designer, going over a few details she needed to check before completing the project. She came out shaking her head, exasperated and befuddled.
Now they want them black, she said. First it was white, now it's black. I have to redo them from scratch.
What will you do with the white ones?
Destroy them, probably. Too kitsch to sell.
Please don't destroy them, Jeffrey said urgently.
No use to me, just clutter up my workplace.
I'll buy them or something, ship them home, but don't destroy them.
She looked touched and surprised.
You'd do that for me, brother?
He nodded solemnly.
Unless you've priced yourself out of my range.
Then they were on their way again, crossing a few more blocks before arriving at what appeared to be, at least by the zone's standard, an entirely nondescript commercial or residential building. Its bulging sides were a mosaic of mirror-bright scales, suggestive of reptilian integument. They went inside and rode an elevator down into its basement levels. Sunday passed Jeffrey a translation earpiece.
Put this on, she said. Chama doesn't do Swahili.
She had poked ahead, and as the doors opened, they were met by a big, intense-looking man. Jeffrey judged him to be about his own age, give or take a decade. Long black hair hung down the sides of his face, in tousled curtains, his skin brown, his beard neat and black, trimmed with laser accuracy.
Chama,
Sunday said, pushing in her own jeweled translator.
This is Jeffrey, my brother. Jeffrey, this is Chama Akbulut.
Chama reached out and took Jeffrey's hand. He said something in a language Jeffrey didn't recognize, while the translation rang clear and near simultaneous.
Heard quite a bit about you.
Nothing bad, I hope.
No, although Sunday did say you wouldn't come up here in a million years. What changed your mind?
Family business, Sunday cut in.
I hope we're not intruding, Jeffrey said.
Always glad of company here.
Chama wore a loose-fitting smock with a drawstring neck under a long leather waistcoat, with a great many pockets and pouches.
You up to speed on the menagerie, Jeffrey?
Not exactly.
Oh, good. That's always the best way.
Chama led them deeper into the building until they were passing along a corridor dug out of solid moon rock, sprayed over with smoke-tinted plastic insulation. Pipes and power lines ran along the ceiling, stapled messily in place.
There are strict rules governing the transportation and utilization of genetic materials within the system, Chama said, looking back over his shoulder. And I'm very proud to say that Gleb and I have broken most of them.
Aren't there good reasons for those rules? Jeffrey asked. No one wants to see people dying because of some ancient virus escaping into the wild.
We're not interested in anything hazardous, Chalmers said. Gleb and I have committed criminal acts only because we're obliged to break certain badly constructed laws. Legislation made by stupid, short-sighted governments.
Jeffrey tensed. In his experience, governments were quite useful things. It was hard to see how the world could have come through the resource and relocation crises without them. But anti-centralist rhetoric came with the territory, here in the de-scrutinized zone. Guess it depends on your intentions, he said.
Had a lot of time for your grandmother, Chalmers said. You think dear old Eunice sat around analyzing her every decision into the ground, looking at it from every possible ethical angle, or did she just, you know, go for it?
They'd arrived at a heavy door, the kind that might lead out onto the surface or into a non-pressurized tunnel system. Chalmers stood to one side and allowed the basketball hoop of an eidetic scanner to lower down over his skull. Chalmers closed his eyes while he visualized the Sphinxware image sequence. The door unlocked with the solid, reassuring clunk of a castle drawbridge and hinged slowly open.
Welcome to the menagerie, Chalmers said.
The room beyond the door was bigger than Jeffrey had been expecting, much larger than the vault in the Central African Bank, but still nowhere near capacious enough to contain a zoo. His eyes took a few moments to adjust to the very low ambient lighting, a soft red radiance bleeding from the edges of the floor. Rectangular panels, too high, divided the walls, but beyond that he couldn't make out more than the sketchiest of details. There was another door at the far end, outlined in pale glowing pink. "Feel I'm missing something here," Jeffrey said. Sunday smiled.
"I think you better show him, Chama."
"Forgive the question, but you're absolutely sure he can be trusted?" Chalmers asked. "He's my brother."
Chalmers evoked something. Polarizing screens winked to transparency. The paneled rectangles in the walls were in fact glass screens. Behind the screens were enclosures rife with vegetation. Jeffrey reeled. It was obvious even from a moment's glance that the habitats differed in subtle and not so subtle ways. Some were flooded with bright equatorial sunlight, the blazing intensity of the noonday savanna. Others had the permanent gloom of the forest floor under a sun-sapping canopy of dense tree cover. Others were steamy or desert arid. He walked to the nearest pair of windows. They were stacked, one above the other, with no sign that the habitats were in any way interdependent. "I don't know as much botany as I should," Jeffrey said, peering at the amazing profusion of plants crammed into the upper window. Their olive leaves were diamonded with dewdrops, or the remnants of a recent rain shower. Under lunar gravity, surface tension shaped liquids into almost perfect hemispheres. "But if there's as much biodiversity in this room as I think there is, this is a pretty amazing achievement."
"We've been growing plants in space since the first space stations," Chalmers said. "Since the days of Salyut, Mir, and the ISS, some of the plant lines here go that far back. Lines nurtured by the first 1,000 people to venture into space. Their hands touched these lineages."
He said this as if he was talking about holy relics fingered by saints.
"But from the outset, the work has always been scientifically and commercially driven. Firstly, to explore the effects of weightlessness on growth mechanisms, then to push our understanding of hydroponics, aeroponics, and so on. Once the ponics techniques had matured sufficiently, we stopped bringing new varieties into space. This is the first time that the majority of these plant species have been established beyond Earth. The difference here is that the driver isn't science or commerce. It's the panspermian imperative."
"Ah," Jeffrey said, with a profound sinking feeling. "Right. I guess I should have seen that one coming."
"You don't approve?" Chama asked.
"Colour me more than slightly sceptical."
That's my brother's way of saying he thinks you're all completely batshit insane,
Sunday explained. He shot her an exasperated glance. Thanks.
Best to get these things out in the open, Sunday said.
Quite, Charmer agreed cordially enough. So, yes, I'm a panspermian, so's Gleb. And yes, we believe in the movement. But that's all it is, an idea. A driving imperative. It's not some crackpot cult.
The door at the far end of the room opened, allowing a figure to enter. It was another man, shorter and stockier than Charmer, pushing a wheeled trolley laden with multicoloured plastic flasks and tubs.
This is my husband, Gleb,
Charmer said.
Gleb, we have visitors. Sunday's brought along her brother.
Gleb propelled the trolley to the wall and walked over to them, peeling gloves from his hands and stuffing them in the pockets of his long white lab coat.
The elephant man. The elephant man, Charmer affirmed.
This is a great pleasure, Gleb said, offering his hand for Jeffrey to shake. Gleb Ozerov, have you seen the...
Not yet, Charmer said. I was just breaking the bad news to him.
What bad news?
That we are batshit insane.
Oh, how's he taking it?
About as well as they usually do.
Jeffrey shook Gleb's hand. He could have crushed diamonds for a living.
You'll get over it eventually.
Gleb studied him with particular attentiveness.
You look disappointed, Jeffrey. Is this not what you are expecting?
It's a room full of plants, Jeffrey said. Not the zoo I was promised. Gleb was a little older than Charmer, a little older looking at least, with Central Asian features, Russian, maybe Mongolian. His hair was dark, but cut very short, and he was clean-shaven. Under the white laboratory coat, Jeffrey had the impression of a compact muscularity, a wrestler's build.
Look, Gleb said, you're a citizen of the African Union, and the AU's a transnational member of the United Service Nations. That means you view things through a certain ideological filter, shall we say.
I think I can see my way past USN propaganda, Jeffrey said.
We're pens. Pens are bankrolled by the United Aquatic Nations, as you undoubtedly know, and the UAN's at permanent loggerheads with the USN. That's the way of the world. But we're not at war. It doesn't mean that pens are about to make a bid for global domination, on Earth or here on the Moon. It's just that we believe in certain unorthodox things.
Gleb's voice, coming in under the translation, was speaking a different language from Charmer, something clipped and guttural, where Charmer's tongue was high and lyrical in intonation. He delivered his oratory with arms folded, muscles bulging under the white fabric of his sleeves.
Pans think that the human species has a duty, a moral obligation, to assist in the proliferation of living organisms into deep space. All living organisms, not just the handful that we happen to want to take with us because they suit our immediate requirements.
We're doing our best, Jeffrey said. It's still early days.
That's one viewpoint, Gleb said cheerfully, especially if you're trying to worm out of species-level responsibility.
This is going really well,
Sunday said.
Yes, Jeffrey said. I've only been here 5 minutes, and already I feel I'm about to be hanged, drawn, and quartered for my crimes against the biosphere.
Charmer and Gleb don't mean it personally, do you? Sunday asked.
We do, but we'll gladly make an exception for your brother, Gleb said with a smile.
Very magnanimous of you, Jeffrey replied.
We have a window here, Charmer said. The human species is poised on the brink of something genuinely transformative. It could be wonderful, an explosion of life and vitality, a green efflorescence, pushing beyond the solar system, into interstellar space. We're on the cusp of being able to do that. But at the same time, we could also be on the cusp of entrenchment, consolidation, even a kind of retreat.
Jeffrey shook his head. Why on earth would we retreat when we've come this far?
Because soon we won't need to be here at all, Gleb said. Soon, very soon, Charmer continued,
Machines will be clever enough to supplant humans throughout the system. Once that happens, what reason will people have to live out in those cold, lonely spaces if they can ching there instead?
Thinking machines won't rise up and crush us, Gleb said. But they will make us over-reliant, unadventurous, unwilling to put our own bodies at risk when machines can stand in for us.
Jeffrey was beginning to wish they'd stayed in the park, with the ice cream stands and battling kites.
I'm not seeing what machines have to do with any of this, he said, gesturing at the glass-fronted enclosures.
Everything, Gleb answered, because this is where it all begins.
Jeffrey peered into the lower window of the glass enclosure. It was a kind of rock pool tableau with low plant cover and bubbling, gurgling water.
How many plant species have you brought here? He asked.
Living and replicating now in the region of 800, Chalmers said. In cryo-suspension or as genetic templates, another 16,000? Still some way to go.
My God, there's something alive in there.
He couldn't help jabbing his finger against the glass.
I mean something moving in the water.
A terrapin, Gleb said, on a bored note. Terrapins are easy. If we couldn't do terrapins, I'd give up now.
Show him what else you do, Sunday said.
Gleb walked to another window a few panels down from where Jeffrey was standing.
Come here, he said, tapping a thick finger against the glass.
The visible portion of the habitat, though it clearly extended far back from the room, was a circle of bare, dusty earth fringed by tall, wheat-colored grasses. Rising above the grasses, a seamless curtain of enamel blue, projected in such a way that it looked as convincing and distant as real sky. As Jeffrey walked over to join Gleb, he kept on tapping his fingernail against the glass. Gleb had very dark nails, tinted a green that was almost black. Jeffrey arrived in time to see the grasses swishing and parting to allow a hair-sized animal to bound into the clearing. It was a battleship grey rhinoceros the size of a domestic cat. It was not a baby. Its proportions and gait, insofar as Jeffrey could tell, and allowing for the bouncing motion that was an inescapable consequence of lunar gravity, were precisely those of a fully grown animal. It just happened to be small enough to fit into a briefcase. He was just satisfying himself as to the accuracy of his assessment when a pair of true babies sprang along behind what was now revealed to be their mother. The babies were the size of rats, but they walked on absurdly thick, muscular, wrinkle-hided legs. They were as tiny and precisely formed as bath toys molded from grey plastic. He laughed, amazed at what he was seeing.
Resource load is the crux, Chalmers said, joining them by the window. We don't have the means to keep fully grown adult specimens alive, at least not in a habitat that wouldn't feel hopelessly claustrophobic to them.
He pushed a strand of hair away from his cheekbone.
Fortunately, for now at least, we don't have to. Nature's already given us a ready-made miniaturization mechanism.
Phyletic dwarfism, Jeffrey said.
Yes, almost childishly easy to achieve in mammals and reptiles.
Chalmers was right. Insular dwarfism often arose when an ancestor species divided into isolated subpopulations on islands. Allopatric speciation and subsequent dwarfism had occurred time and again in the evolutionary record, from dwarf allosaurs to the Homo floresiensis hominids in Indonesia. Even trees did it. It was a gene-encoded response to environmental stress, a way of allowing a population to survive hard times.
The same mechanisms will assist animal life transition through the difficult bottleneck of the early stages of the green efflorescence, Gleb declared. All we've done is give the inbuilt mechanism a little coaxing to produce extreme dwarfism. It's as if nature anticipated this future survival adaptation.
A little coaxing sounded like a magisterial understatement to Jeffrey. Given the toy-like proportions of the rhinoceroses. But he could well believe that Chalmers and Gleb hadn't needed to perform much deep-level genetic tinkering to achieve it.
Certainly there was no evidence that the dwarf animals were in any way traumatized by their condition. Judging by the way they were happily snuffling and shuffling around, the babies nudging each other boisterously. Gleb had retrieved the wheeled trolley, dug some granular foodstuff out of one of the containers, and was now sprinkling it down into the enclosure, via the hopper above the window. The dwarf rhinoceroses must have taken his fingernail tapping as the sign that dinner was imminent.
"It's an ingenious solution to the problem," Jeffrey said.
"You'll find it troubling," Charmer said.
"I wonder whether it might have been better to keep these organisms on ice until you had the means to grow them to full size.
Even if that meant waiting decades?"
The green efflorescence doesn't sound like a short-term plan. It felt odd to speak of the efflorescence himself, as if by voicing its name he had bestowed upon the enterprise a measure of legitimacy, even tacit approval. He was still undecided as to whether it might be some kind of vile, misanthropic eco-fascism. He would need to know a lot more before he made up his mind.
"These animals don't know they're dwarfs," Gleb said, patiently enough. "On a neurological and behavioral level, there's no evidence of developmental impairment. There's a huge redundancy in brain tissue. It's why birds are at least as good at problem-solving as primates, even given the massive disparity in cranial volume. So we have no ethical qualms whatsoever. Chama and I wouldn't countenance the creation of misery merely to serve some distant utopian objective."
"They do look happy enough," he allowed.
"We won't deny that there are difficulties still to be overcome with some of the other species."
Something ominous clicked in Jeffrey's head. If you can do rhinoceroses, you can do mammoths and elephants.
"It's been a while, but I remember something about dwarf populations in those species. The Cretan elephants, the mammoths in the Bering Sea Islands."
"We can do proboscidea," Charma said. "And we have. But there are difficulties."
He led Jeffrey and Sunday to one of the far windows. Jeffrey's stomach churned with apprehension.
"I'm not sure this is right."
Gleb was pushing the trolley again.
"Always scope for improvement, but that doesn't mean the elephant should be put on ice or euthanized."
Compared to the rhino habitat, the grass was lower, scrubbier, dry and bleached like the Serengeti before the short rains. In the middle distance lay a waterhole, now reduced to a muddy depression. Standing on the far side of the waterhole, clumped together into one multi-legged, multi-headed, cubist mass, were three dwarf elephants. They were the size of baby goats, grey bodies camouflaged with olive-brown patches of drying mud.
"Tell me how these elephants were born," he said.
"In artificial wombs here in the discrutinized zone," Gleb replied. "The fertilized eggs were imported, carried in vivo, in human mules. Chama and I both carried eggs, and we've both fallen foul of the Indian and Chinese lunar authorities at various times."
"You'd need hundreds, thousands, for a viable population, though."
Chama nodded.
"We have hundreds, but so far only these elephants have been allowed to be born."
"Just these three?"
"As many as the habitat can reasonably support," Chama said.
Jeffrey had been agnostic about the rhinoceroses. Now his distaste sharpened into precise, targeted revulsion.
"This is wrong. No matter what your objectives, you can't do this to these animals."
"Jeffrey," Sunday began. He ignored her.
"Elephants aren't born into a vacuum. They're born into a complex, nurturing society with a strong maternal hierarchy. An elephant clan might contain 30 to 100 individuals, and there are strong inter-clan bonds as well. What you're doing here is the equivalent of dropping human babies into isolation cubes."
Sunday's hand was on his arm. She tightened her grip.
"They're not unaware of these issues, brother."
Charma appeared in no way offended by Jeffrey's outburst.
"From the moment these habitats were conceived,
We knew that the elephants would need surrogate families to provide a developmental context, so we devised the best way to provide that surrogacy. From the time they were embryos, these animals have grown with neuromachinery in their heads. That shouldn't horrify you, should it?
Not necessarily, but it depends what you do with that machinery, Jeffrey said. These elephants need a socializing context, Gleb responded. So we provide it. The neuromachines drop hallucinations into their minds via direct activation of the visual, auditory, and olfactory modules. We create figments, in other words, a ghost herd, to provide stimulus and guidance. The elephants move in augmented reality just as we do when we ching. The difference is we know that figments are figments. Elephants don't have the cognitive apparatus to make that distinction.
If they did, the figments would be pointless, said Charmer.
The figments are computer-generated, but they're based on observations of millions of hours of the social dynamics in real herds, Gleb said. The same database reassures us that the dwarves' responses are fully in line with what would be expected if the figments were real. These are not developmentally impoverished creatures. Well, if you've no qualms...
I didn't say we've achieved shining perfection, Gleb countered.
Computer-generated figments may provide some kind of stabilizing framework, Jeffrey conceded, choosing his words with tightrope precision. But elephants are individuals. They have memories, emotions. They can't be modeled by mindless software. Maybe these dwarves won't grow into monsters, but they won't turn into fully socialized elephants either.
No, Charmer agreed. But you could help matters so that they do.
Help you? I'm on the verge of pushing for your extradition on the grounds of Schedule 1 biocrimes.
We are aware of your work, Gleb said. We've read your papers. Some of them are quite good.
He allowed this calculated slight to hang in the air before continuing. We know what you have been doing with the Emboseli herds.
If you know my work, Jeffrey said, then you should have guessed that I wouldn't be too keen on any of this.
We also saw that you might be able to provide a possible solution, Charmer said.
Jeffrey hooked a finger into his belt. This I'm fascinated to hear.
We know of your matriarch, Matilda. We followed her with passive ching. She's magnificent. She also has neuromachinery, as do most of your elephants.
As a monitoring tool, nothing else.
But the same neuromachinery with a few configuration resets could provide an org layer.
I'm not sure where you're going with this.
But he was surer than he cared to admit, even to himself.
These dwarf elephants already interact with hallucinations, Gleb said. Instead of being computer-generated fictions, why couldn't they be ching figments of Matilda and her clan? There's no reason why Matilda and her elephants couldn't perceive the Luna dwarfs as being physically present in the basin, as another family or group of orphans in need of adoption. By the same token, the Luna dwarfs could experience real-time interaction with genuine Emboseli elephants, as if they were here on the moon.
Jeffrey didn't need to think through the technical implications. Charmer and Gleb had undoubtedly considered every possible wrinkle. He shook his head, sadly.
Even if it could be done, it wouldn't work. My elephants have never encountered dwarves, and your elephants have never encountered fully grown adults. They wouldn't know what to make of each other.
The size differential doesn't matter, Charmer said. It can be edited out via the Qing, along with the morphological differences between the two populations. Each group would perceive the other as being perfectly normal. This can be done, Jeffrey. It's beyond trivial.
I'm sorry, he said. It's taken me years to establish a bond of trust with Matilda and her family. I can't betray that trust by manipulating her basic experience of reality.
Tom wasn't giving up.
From Matilda's point of view, from the point of view of her whole family, it would be a minor detail in the scheme of things.
3 new elephants, that's all. Orphans are routinely adopted by families, aren't they?
And sometimes left to die, Jeffrey said.
But it does happen. It's not something strange and alien by elephant standards, Gleb said. Meanwhile, all the other complex herd interactions would proceed perfectly normally. The benefits to the orphans, however, would be incalculable. Having grown up in a stabilizing framework, the orphans would then be in a position to mentor a second generation of lunar dwarves through to adulthood. Before very long, we would have the basis of an entirely independent and self-perpetuating elephant society here on the moon.
By assisting us, Charma said, you can be part of something heroic.
The green efflorescence.
Put that aside for now, Gleb said. Just think of these elephants and what they could become. What wonders, what companionship.
Companionship. Jeffrey did his best not to sneer. As pets, you mean? Charma shook his head.
As cognitive equals. Think of all the crimes we've committed against their kind. Down all the blood-red centuries, the atrocities, the injustices, the carnage and the cruelty. Now, think of us giving them the stars.
In return.
As what? Recompense? It wouldn't begin to balance our misdeeds, Charma said.
Then a softness entered his voice.
But it would be something.
The old place, Sunday was relieved to see, wasn't as busy as she had feared.
Any chance of a table in the Japanese module? She asked, as they stooped into the dingy, angular, off-white interior of the International Space Station.
Follow me, said a blue, boiler-suited staffer, shoulders embroidered with the patches of various barely remembered space agencies. It had been Sunday's idea for them all to meet up again, Charma and Gleb included, when they were done with their day's work. The zookeepers could be overwhelming until you built up sufficient exposure tolerance. Sunday had passed that point years ago. The wilder excesses of their starry-eyed idealism now ghosted through her like a flux of neutrinos. Besides, it was about time she broke something else to Jeffrey. The Echinias were already embroiled.
So, she said, when they were on the first round of drinks, what did you think of Charma and Gleb?
They've achieved a lot, Jeffrey said.
I don't necessarily approve of all of it, but I can't deny the trouble they've gone to or the risks they've taken.
But you're still uneasy about the whole pan thing, Jitendra said, cradling a huge stein of beer.
I'm not big on cults or cultists, I'm afraid.
Look, Sunday said, there's something that might put things in a different light. Like it or not, we're already involved.
Who's we?
Us, the family. I'm talking ancient history now, but it's the truth. Have you heard of a woman called Lin Wei?
Jeffrey made no visible effort to search his memory. Can't say I have.
She's the prime pan, the woman who started the whole movement way back when. Lot of radical thinkers around then. Extropians, transhumanists, long-lifers, the clock of the long now, the Mars Society, a dozen other space advocacy types with, on the face of it, not a lot to agree on. Lin Wei still got them all to sit down and agree on common ground. Some of them said no thanks and went their own way. But Lin found points of agreement with others, shared objectives. She was very charismatic. Out of that came the Pan-Spermian Initiative and the basis for the UAN.
Jeffrey smiled nicely. And your point is?
Lin Wei and Eunice were best friends, that's my point.
Oh, he said.
Eunice was never a pan, not on any formal level, but the connection was there right through her career. The pans were heavy backers in something called Ocular.
She took a sip of her wine.
You heard of it?
Remind me.
Ocular was the first step towards exoplanet colonization. A telescope big enough to image surface features
on an Earth-like planet beyond our solar system. Well, they built it. Nearly. The project fell to pieces halfway through, and that was the start of the big falling out between Lynn and Eunice.
Jeffrey's interest appeared to be perking up. What happened?
Hard to say, other than that it had something to do with Mercury. That was where they were assembling the parts for the telescope and launching them into space. We were helping with the shipment of materials and know-how. Not a free lunch, though. Eunice and Lynn might have been pals, but this was business. But the Pans weren't paying us directly. In return for our services, the Akinyas got to piggyback their own startup venture on Mercury.
What kind of venture?
That's where it gets murky. I'm in the family, and even I can't get to the bottom of what went wrong.
Sunday couldn't help but lower her voice. It was a pointless but unavoidable response.
We built a facility there to tap into the same solar power grid the Pans were using for their ocular assembly and launch plant. What we did in that facility, well, that's not easy to say. The cover story was physics research, which makes a sort of sense. We were involved in propulsion system design, and you need a lot of energy to do anything worthwhile in that area. But it appears that was just a smokescreen.
Wish my family was half as interesting, Jitendra said. He had brought the plastic jewels with him, and was pushing them into cryptic little configurations around the damp circle left by his stein.
Trust me, Sunday said. You really don't need a family as interesting as ours.
A smokescreen? For what exactly? Jeffrey asked.
For bad machines,
Sunday said.
Artilects. Like the one that got into my head when I fell down that hole. Nothing's been proved, but it looks as if we were using our means and resources to smuggle contraband artilects to Mercury, under the noses of the authorities, for the purposes of reverse engineering and duplication, making sure we'd be ahead of the game if and when the gearheads relaxed the ties on AI research.
Her brother stroked a finger under his chin. How much of this is guesswork?
Lin Wei had her own suspicions, so she conducted some espionage against us, Sunday said. Sent industrial spies into our organization, found out about the Artilect research. That was the start of the bad feeling. Not only had we lied about our intentions, but we were developing thinking machines. Needless to say, Lin Wei took that as a grave personal insult. As well she might. It was a betrayal of a lifetime's friendship and trust. Meanwhile, the gearheads had been following their own lines of investigation. They closed in on Mercury, aiming to make a forced inspection.
What happened?
By the time they broke into the facility, it had been trashed. Deliberate sabotage, to hide any evidence of a crime. Big stink at the time. Damaged us and the Pans, but we both bounced back. Ocular was the only real casualty. With the breakdown in relations between the Akinyas and the Pans, the project was left half-finished.
Sunday nodded in the vague direction of the ceiling to the lunar bedrock and the vacuum above their heads.
Still out there. Still gathering data, just not as extensively as they planned.
And the moral of this tale? Jeffrey asked.
Just that we're already in bed with the Pans, brother. The marriage might not be something anyone likes to talk about now, but you can't undo history.
Whatever Eunice got up to, it's nothing to do with me or my elephants.
No, but it might have something to do with me, Sunday said. Maybe they know stuff about Eunice I can't find out from anyone else.
Something dawned in Jeffrey's eyes. So that's why we have to dine with Chama and Gleb. Sunday bottled up her exasperation. She was asking so little of Jeffrey. Why, for once in his life, couldn't he think of the bigger picture?
They're just bit players, brother. They don't have the keys to every Pan secret. But if we help them, maybe they can get someone else to help us. It's reciprocity.
That visit to the zoo didn't just happen on the spur of the moment, did it?
Sunday noticed Chama and Gleb being shown to the table, stooping beneath the low-hanging handrails and equipment lockers bolted to what was now the ceiling, but which had once been just another usable surface of the ISS.
Sunday and Jitendra budged up to make room for the zookeepers.
Chama leaned in and reached for Jeffrey's hand. good to see you again, he said, grinning broadly.
Jeffrey returned the handshake, but his response was dour. Nice to see you too. Gleb was no longer wearing his laboratory overcoat, and Charmer had divested his waistcoat pockets of some of their bulkier contents. Other than that, they hadn't changed much since the meeting at the zoo.
So, Jitendra, Sunday said brightly while Charmer and Gleb buried their faces in the drinks menu, any news on Eunice?
Sunday, Jeffrey said. She fixed on a puzzled expression.
What?
I'm not sure that's something we really ought to be discussing in public.
Charmer and Gleb have already confided in us about their own work, Sunday said. The least we can do is return the favor, wouldn't you say?
Right, Jeffrey said, shooting her a look that let her know exactly what he thought about that. Charmer looked up. We don't want to cause any awkwardness.
My brother's referring to some family business, not a state secret, Sunday said, and I don't think there'll be any harm at all in you knowing about it.
Jitendra smiled awkwardly. Maybe I've got something, possibly. While you are out, I decided to sniff around Pythagoras and see what I could find. Ching resolution isn't ideal, not enough public eyes on that part of the moon to give seamless coverage, which is a bit of a problem if you're trying to do some amateur sleuthing. Which we're not, Jeffrey said firmly. But encouraging in another sense, Jitendra went on, as it confirms what we suspected all along. Any tracks Eunice put down there in 2059 won't have been disturbed in the meantime. He beamed deliciously, pleased at his own cleverness. Well, they have been and they haven't. He shoved aside the condiments, pushed the colored gems into a huddle, and voked a rectangular image onto the table. It was filled with the silver-gray, gritty, deep-shadowed terrain of the high-latitude lunar landscape. Cross-haired and annotated with coordinates, the image must have been shot from some high-flying satellite. Close-up of the interior of Pythagoras' crater. Time-stamped about 8 weeks ago, Jitendra said. Recent enough for our purposes.
Have you found the crash point? Sunday asked.
That and more. He laced his fingers and cracked knuckles. Let me zoom in for you. Gleb said, the crash point of what?
Eunice landed or crashed in this crater 103 years ago, Sunday told him. It's looking as if she's left us something related to that incident.
The rectangle stayed the same size, but now the image had enlarged to reveal the whitish, many-armed star, not exactly a crater, more a frozen splash, where something had splatted onto the lunar surface. The star was elongated and asymmetric, as if the impacting object had skipped in obliquely. There was even a smaller blemish to one side of it, as if the object had bounced once before coming to rest. It looks bad, but we know it was a survivable impact, Jitendra said. No trace of a ship, though, Jeffrey said, reluctantly succumbing to curiosity. You're sure it's the right place? Nowhere else fits. The ship isn't there because it was recovered by that Indian salvage crew. Jitendra made the image zoom in again, jabbing his finger at the tabletop. They had their own ship. Here's where they kicked up soil on landing, and here are their foot and rover prints, scribbled all over Eunice's crater, fresh now as when they were made. That's all, though. No one's been back to that landing site in a century.
What about Eunice's long walk out? Sunday asked.
We can follow her all the way out of the crater. Hers are the only footprints anywhere else in Pythagoras. The view lurched to the right, tracking east. Sunday made out the footprints, following an arrow straight line with only occasional detours to avoid obstacles. It was a long, monotonous message in Morse code. Stretches of hyphens where she had been hop-skipping, interspersed with sequences of dots where she had slowed her progress to a walk. When Jitendra zoomed out again, reducing the prints to the faintest of scratches across the image, she understood how far Eunice had been forced to travel. A tiny human presence, a bag of air and warmth lost in the barren immensity of the lunar landscape, like a bug crossing a runway. We can follow these prints all the way to the wall and over and out, to where she met the Chinese rescue party, Jitendra said. You can still see the hairpin where they turned the rover around and drove back home with Eunice aboard. It all checks out. Sunday exhaled.
Okay, so her story checks out. Is that all you've got?
There is something slightly weird. He let the image scroll and zoom again, once more picking up the line of prints. We're just over 30 kilometers from the touchdown site here, Jitendra said. And suddenly, there's this.
Oh, yes, Sharma said.
North of the prints, maybe 100 meters, lay an area of blasted soil where a ship had touched down. Sunday could see clearly the cruciform pattern of depressions made by its landing legs. There were footprints as well, two rows, running from the ship to the original line of footprints and back again. It didn't take a forensics expert to note that the spacing of the prints was similar, maybe identical, to Eunice's walking pattern. Where the prints intersected the original line, there was a region of scuffed soil. For about 5 meters, Eunice's original prints had been erased again.
She went back, Sunday said.
Grief! She actually went back!
Jitendra nodded. That's what it looks like. After the Chinese had rescued her, and we could be talking weeks, months, years, who the hell knows, she returned to this exact spot and did something.
Looks as if she dug up the ground, Gleb said. Either to recover something she buried there last time, or to bury something new. Can you dig back and find older imagery?
Gleb's right, Sunday said. If we can find a view taken after she was rescued but before the fresh prints came in, it'll help us narrow things down.
I'm searching, Jitendra said, but I'm also being careful. Don't want to leave my grubby fingerprints all over an image trawl.
No one else is following this trail, Jeffrey said. Or at least they weren't, until my sister started talking about it to anyone who'd listen.
What we really need to do is get out there, see what's under the soil, Sunday said.
Might be a bit problematic, Jitendra said.
Pythagoras is under Chinese lunar administration now. You don't mess with the ghost wall.
Good job we won't be doing that then, Jeffrey said.
Aren't you even remotely curious? Sunday asked.
It's all supposition based on a few smudges.
We'd know for sure if we went there, she said. Take a couple of spades, maybe rent an excavator. How long do you think it would take us?
With the Chinese breathing down our necks, wondering what we're prospecting for? Exactly how long do you think it would be before word of that got back to the cousins? Going through official channels isn't the way to do this, Jitendra said.
I have a suggestion, Sharma said.
He looked at his husband, Gleb, giving only the tiniest of encouraging nods. Their drinks arrived. Sharma made a point of swallowing a finger's width from his before speaking again.
Whatever happens, this is going to be a possible arrest and detention scenario involving our good friends, the Chinese. Now, while that's not something either of us would rush into, it's not like we don't have prior experience in that area.
Doesn't mean they'll let you go the next time, Jeffrey said.
It's not like we're trafficking. We'll just be doing some digging on Chinese soil. Hardly the crime of the century, is it?
Gleb was speaking now.
The initiative isn't without influence in Chinese circles, and you've got Jun Wing in your corner. The right words, the right persuasion, will be back on the street soon enough.
Or not, Jeffrey said.
We'll accept that risk.
Charmer leaned forwards, elbows on the table.
You find out what's under that soil, we get something from you in return. How about it, Elephant Man?
He shook his head. We went over this already. I'm not getting involved.
All we want in return, Gleb said, is to offer you the chance to help with our dwarves.
I'm already being emotionally blackmailed by my family, thanks. I don't need another dose.
It's really nothing what we're asking, Charma said reasonably.
He took another gulp of his beer and wiped foam onto the back of his hand.
The risk's all on our side. No one else needs to know about your involvement.
There's still the small matter of ethical oversight, Jeffrey said.
Oh, screw that, Gleb said.
For a start, they'd have to learn of the existence of the dwarves, and we're not ready to go public. Jeffrey looked relieved, as if he'd finally found an insuperable objection.
Then it can't be done.
Even if we got the neuromachinery communicating, someone somewhere will want to know why there's so much Qing traffic between my elephants and the de-scrutinized zone. We can get around that, Charma said. The initiative already has more than enough surplus quangle paths between Earth and the Moon. Not unbreakable, of course, but the next best thing.
You're going to have to work pretty hard to think of something they haven't already covered, Sunday said.
Other than the fact that if I take part in this, that makes me a criminal as well?
No one need know, Gleb countered. Anyway, in the scheme of things, you'd still have the moral high ground, wouldn't you? You were just presented with a situation, a fait accompli, which you agreed to improve.
He looked at his husband and said something that the earpieces didn't pick up, some language or dialect too obscure for translation.
I'm sure there could be financial incentives as well,
Charma said after a few moments' reflection.
No promises, but it wouldn't be out of the question. You're reliant on handouts from your family right now, aren't you?
My funding flows from a number of sources, Jeffrey said, glaring at Sunday.
Charma shrugged, but I'm sure more autonomy would always be welcome.
Sunday saw her chance.
While we're thrashing out terms, I'd like some access to your archives.
What exactly are you after? Charma inquired. Sunday hesitated before answering.
My grandmother knew your founder, Lin Wei. They went to the same school in what used to be independent Tanzania before the Federation. Here.
And she cleared part of the table to evoke her own image, which was of two girls of similar age. One was her grandmother. The other was Lin Wei. Lin Wei wore a red dress, white stockings, and black shoes. Sunday glanced at her brother, nodded once. It was clear from the look in her eyes that she had also made the connection with the mysterious girl at the scattering, the stranger with the unresolvable Qing bind.
Eunice knew the Prime Pan?
Gleb asked, astonished.
How could this not have come to light before?
I only discovered it recently myself,
Sunday said, shifting on her seat. This was a lie, but in the scheme of things, only a white one. Or perhaps off-white.
It's a part of our family history that's been swept under the carpet, she went on. Same on your side, by the sound of things. They were good friends. They ended up collaborating on the Mercury Project. But Eunice abused Lin Wei's trust somehow. I don't know how much contact they had afterwards.
Eunice only just died, Jeffrey said.
Yes, Sunday said. I had noticed.
What I mean is, she wasn't that old, not by modern standards, so if she went to school with this Lin Wei person, what's to say Lin Wei isn't still alive? Never mind the archive, never mind the pants. You could just ask her directly.
I'm afraid not,
Charma said sadly.
Lin Wei was the Prime Pan. She died decades ago.
Sunday nodded.
That's what I heard as well. I think she drowned or something horrible like that.